Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
And today we've got another installment of our Dead White Scientist series, which we do because it's so cool. And this was all about who was the first person to fly, or did they really have the right stuff?
That's pathetic. That's your worst line ever.
Oh my gosh.
You're out of practice.
All right. So, Annie, who was the first person to fly a heavier-than-air airplane?
Alberto Santos.
Give me the response that most Americans
Okay. The Wright brothers. That's what we learn in school.
Right. We do.
And they were brilliant guys, but they weren't the first.
Well, maybe they were. Maybe they weren't. This is the thing.
Well, wait a minute. In Brazil.
Oh, well,
this
in Brazil.
Is where we learned this information.
And in France, of course, they all, most Americans believe it was the Wright brothers. Most of the rest of the world will point to Alberto Santos Dumont. And actually, in 2013, the state of Connecticut passed a bill recognizing that Gustav Whitehead was the first person to fly a heavier-than-air airplane. So who was the first person to fly?
All right, tell us who it was, Jay. Just give us the cold, hard facts.
All right. Well, I think what we need to know, you know, we have this vision that things happen, you know, like some guy in, and it's always some dead white scientist, right? He's in his laboratory and he's working
on
something.
Well, he's not dead at the time.
No, well, probably not. But then, he gets this amazing insight, and poof, out of thin air comes the light bulb, comes the telephone, comes the airplane,
telegraph,
whatever. It doesn't happen that way, right? As we always like to say, one person does one thing and another does another thing, and they all build on each other, and then they find out that, you know, 1,000 years ago the Chinese had been doing it anyway. And anyway, so the history of aviation is very similar to this. Back in the late 1700s, with the discovery of hydrogen, they started making balloons, right? Because everybody, since they saw a bird fly, they've wanted to fly.
But I think the Chinese did that before the 1700s.
Yeah, actually, they had been doing it since the 3rd century B.C.
Yeah, see, but those Chinese, darn it, they're just way ahead of
the
time.
The Europeans figured it out. And then our buddy, Alberto Santos Dumont, actually took this balloon concept. Because up until this time, a balloon just goes up and it comes down, right? Wherever it happens to come down, that's where it comes down. Well, he figured out how to take an internal combustion motor or engine and attach that to a balloon, and he created what is basically a blimp. And back in 1901, he was really credited as the first person to have a controlled flight, where he took this blimp and flew it around the Eiffel Tower to the amazement of all the French guys, and they raised this little Brazilian guy up on their shoulders and said, hip, hip, hooray.
But was this the science organization? Like, wasn't there like a universal science group club or something that set up some rules for that?
Yeah, well, there was the Aero Club de France, and this was all happening at the same time. You know, everybody knew things were going to happen. So the Aero Club de France.
Something's going to fly.
Well, all the technologies were coming together. Okay. You had these blimps. Then Ferdinand von Zeppelin, he made a rigid balloon, which was referred to as a dirigible, but we call them Zeppelins after Ferdinand. And he started flying it around. So as happens, all the men got together, all the aristocratic men, because most people are just working, trying to make a living. It's only the wealthy people who have the time to putter around with balloons and dirigibles and blimps. And so they're...
Also, they probably were the ones that had more education.
Maybe.
Because they had access to real
education.
They
felt they were more educated.
Yeah, well, that's white guys all the way around.
So they're mansplaining to the world, you know, how this stuff works, right? So we had the flying fever, and there were people working with gliders as well, balloons, Zeppelins, dirigibles. You've got this club, the Aero Club de France.
I got this picture in my mind of these. It's like a It's like a Monty Python picture, you know. They're flying all over the place and everywhere you look.
Hey, Bruce. Hi, Bruce. So anyway, so this fellow, Sir George Cayley, he's actually known as the father of the airplane, even though he didn't build any airplanes. He was really the first person in these in the mid-1800s to define why birds fly, why airplanes fly, you know, about the lower pressure over the wing and the idea of aerodynamics. And they actually started building wind tunnels and they were testing these things. And then they started building model airplanes, model gliders. So everything's coming together. The will to fly, the technology, you've got the internal combustion engine, you've got the idea of aerodynamics, so people are studying it. You've got wealthy men willing to invest money into these projects. So you knew something was going to break loose right around the turn of the century, right? Late 1800s, early 1900s.
But all I can think about is who was insane enough to get in those things and try to take off.
These daring young men and their flying machines, you know?
I can't
imagine. And actually, a lot of the first ones died.
I know it.
I mean, you get up in this little airplane and or, you know, those old film reels of jumping, you know, off a building or something.
Yeah.
And, just plummet, you know? So,
yeah.
So these guys,
when I was a kid, my dad, he worked in the aerospace industry. And we must have been about four or five, but I'll never forget it. So there had been a plane that he had been working on. He was a cost analyst, and it had crashed. It was a plane that they'd built for the Air Force. And so he took us out to show us the crash site, and then he told the most horrible story about how the thing started to take off, and then it just plopped on the ground and then went boom, 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 like it was bouncing and then burst into flames. And, of course, the guy died. And then he told another horrible story about how that all happened. And we're all standing there looking at the plane and looking at him. And my brother said to me later, let's not go there anymore. We were only like 4 or 5 years old.
Well, actually, the first person involved in the first fatal airplane crash was Orville Wright. He was flying with a passenger who is a major or captain or something in the military, and they crashed. The propeller caught one of the metal guy wires or something, and the whole thing went down. And Orville Wright was severely injured. I think he broke his back, maybe. But the other guy was killed, and that was the very first fatal airplane crash. Now, there had been glider crashes. There had been, of course, balloon crashes and dirigible. But it's dangerous. I mean, this is any new scientific
endeavor. I just can't imagine. I just can't imagine it. That's all.
Yep. So here we have, we're poised. The technology is in place. We're ready to take off, right? And but these are gentlemen scientists. And most of them, you know, what is it? Your eyes are bigger than your stomach. I mean, their ego was bigger than their brain, you know. So.
But they're the gentry, you know. They have
so
money.
They're always right.
They are always right. Everybody says, yes, that's good. You do whatever. And countries were competing with each other.
Sure.
Around advances in science and technology even then. So somebody wants to be first.
Well, and enter the secretary of the Smithsonian Institution.
Okay, there we
the
go.
The Right Honorable Samuel Pierpont Langley. He is.
Could you explain what the Smithsonian is?
Yeah, well, the Smithsonian, I mean, many kids who go on their eighth grade field trip to Washington, D.C., you go to the Smithsonian, and it's a large museum, basically,
well,
or a number
of
museums.
They are the museums of this country, really.
Yeah, and so it was still quite an important, or already quite an important institution at this point. So Samuel Pierpont Langley really had the pedigree to be the first person to fly, because he knew everything and he was a man of position. So he began to investigate aerodynamics with the University of Pittsburgh. And in 1896, he made the first successful unmanned flight of a full-sized airplane. So, of course, the government stepped in and gave him $50,000, which is
a huge amount of money.
Yeah. And he was to then build the first airplane. You know, it was like, it's sort of like he was anointed to be the first person to fly. Problem was, he didn't do it. I mean, he tried and he spent a lot of money and he was sure he was right, but his plane crashed. Like every time it took off, it crashed and it never really took off. So he tested it in November of 1903. And in front of huge numbers of spectators and all of the media and all of this stuff, they did this, and it was a disaster, crashed into the Hudson River or some river. Maybe it's Chesapeake Bay. I don't remember. Anyway, big failure and quite an embarrassment. And the media had a field day. Yeah, look at all the money everybody's wasted. In the meantime, the Wright brothers are down at Kitty Hawk, pretty much doing their thing all by themselves, not really in the public eye. And just a couple of weeks later, their famous flight where their plane took off. Now, there was a problem, right? Langley, he's out in front of hundreds, thousands of people demonstrating this. The Wright brothers are sitting here on a remote beach in North Carolina. And actually, it was there were three guys from a life-saving crew, a local businessman, and a local kid, right, who was told that they were actually testing a thing that could catch ducks. So he thought that was pretty cool. So they're the only witnesses. Now, they flipped a coin to see who goes first. Wilbur,
well, who's going to fly the plane, you
right,
mean?
Wilbur won the toss. Now, Wilbur was kind of the brains of the operation. He won the toss. Started to take off and it didn't work. So then when they got their second flight, it was Orville's turn. And Orville, of course, is credited with that first flight, which was only, you know, a couple hundred feet. It kind of bounced off. And the reason they were in Kitty Hawk is because there were prevailing winds that helped the flight. They actually had it on skids. It went down a ramp. And so it was rudimentary. But these guys were bicycle repairmen, speaking of Monty Python, and they were experimenters. They weren't really at this moment concerned about who was first, who was second, public attention. They were taciturn young men from Dayton.
And how long after the DeMont flight was this?
Well, you're just wanting to you're an advocate for the Brazilian position.
I'm not. I'm an advocate for the gossip.
Oh, for the gossip. All right.
Let's go for the gossip. I don't care.
Well, so Orville, he flew it, and then they tried to fly it again. I think they did a couple of flights. Anyway, then the wind took the plane and smashed it all up. And actually, the very first plane to fly, they left it with one of the guys there who was helping them, and they said, why don't you tear this thing apart, use the wood for firewood, and use the sails, the wing, to make some nice clothes for your family, which is basically what they did.
In those days, that would have the plane would have been built of a little wooden
right.
skeleton and then covered in some kind of gauze material, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's like a spruce, I think. Spruce, a light, heavy, strong wood, but very light, obviously.
In fact, in their test flights,
they actually tested it like a kite. They had it tied and they could get it to go up into the air.
Wow.
Just testing it like a flight. Well, and with that.
Like a kite, you mean?
Like a kite in a flight. With that, we're listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, reminding you. It is indeed the end of the world as we know it.
And thank God.
Thank God, Annie. So anyway, we're doing our Dead White Scientist series, and we're talking about who was indeed first to fly. So we've been talking a little bit about the Wright brothers. Of course, they're credited, in the United States at least, with being the first to fly. But many people in the world will dispute this. So here they are. Locked away in secrecy down on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And then they made the claim that they flew. Of course, there were only just a couple of local folks who saw it. And they went back to Dayton, kept experimenting with their plane. But then they tried getting everything patented, and they were involved in trying to sell this to the United States military. That was their whole shtick, really. They wanted to get in, get out, make a bunch of money, sell this thing to the military, and who knows, go back to their bicycles or whatever.
So they had a different rationale, whereas the Alberto guy, he was a part of a science society, and their thing was really promoting the science of aviation and who's going to be first to get that kind of thing going and the patents that are involved.
Yeah, and the Aero Club de France, which was formed in 1898, had a lot of distinguished members, including Alberto Santa-Dumont, but Jules Verne and his wife, what do you know?
They allowed a woman in?
I know.
Was she a scientist?
I don't know. She was his wife.
She must have. No, she must
That's
have been a
scientist.
That's how
she's always listed.
Really? Oh, no name. She doesn't get to even have a name.
And André Michelin of Michelin Tires.
Wow.
He was there. So anyway, they set up the rules of what constitutes a first flight. And some of those rules was it must be attended by the public. It must take off, have sustained flight, land on its own, all witnessed by people.
All of it from the beginning to the end.
Right, and pre-announced, so there were no unusual weather conditions, things of that nature. Well, even by 1906, the Wright brothers still were using a catapult. They had this catapult that launched their airplane into the air. Now, they argued otherwise they would need too much of a runway and the weight, you know, was too great. So it was an assisted takeoff, which violated the Aero Club de France's rules. So Alberto Santa-Dumont, who you were asking about, in 1906, he had a flight that met all of the Aero Club de France's rules. That's why most of those folks in France and Brazil, places of that nature, they argue that he was really the first one to fly. Part of it was this kind of classist prejudice, because all of the gentlemen, in quotes, absolutely could not believe that two middle-class bicycle guys who were the sons of a preacher in Dayton, Ohio, who didn't really care about the refined, you know, niceties of modern society, they simply were not bred well enough to be the first. So that was kind of the overlaying template that caused a lot of the pushback in the early days.
But they were also a whole different kind of person. They never married.
Right.
They were very close to their father. He was quite well known.
And their sister.
Yeah. And I think they had another brother, but he wasn't involved. And so they spent their whole life just being scientists, doing what they did. It wasn't really about meeting some criteria.
Well, their sister was the first woman to go up in an airplane. And their father went up in an airplane when he was in his 80s. He was the oldest man ever to go up in an airplane. And I think in retrospect, there's...
You mean the first man that old to go up?
Yeah. There's a lot of evidence that contradicts this kind of pushback of the time that says, okay, you guys are not smart enough to be the first people to fly, because they were very smart. They were very good engineers. And I think that's what it required at this moment in time. The theory was all in place. What you needed is somebody good with their hands to sit there and say, I'm going to put this thing together. You know, we all know people who are smart in theory, but they blow up anything they ever touch,
right.
You know. And that's kind of where Langley was. He was maybe smart in theory, but he was not a technician. And this was the moment that required a technician. And the Wright brothers were technicians.
I love this, though, because I'm a big fan of Ohio, as you know, and Ohio, as we say here. But
the heart of it all.
That's right. And it is for me. And I love this because there were a lot of great things happening in Ohio during those days. And Ohio were producing a lot of people who were presidents and scientists and artists. And so I like the fact that they were down-home boys who really didn't care about the ritzy part. They were just about doing their job. That seems like who we have been as a people.
Well, and it fed into that American myth, you know, of the the quiet, you know, I don't care, I don't need the adulation, yeah. I'm going to just keep my nose to the grindstone.
Right. Do the hard work, that's what I'm saying. Work.
Instead of some Brazilian guy, fancy man in his little suit. Well, with Alberto Santodomas, of course, he became quite famous worldwide. But eventually, he became very distraught that the airplane began to be used in warfare. And that was a big issue.
That seemed like
it
should have been a no-brainer. But
well, the Wright brothers, that's they're like,
look
at this,
man. That was their thing. That's right. They set
go
the
to
tone.
We're going to go to the military first.
Yeah, and
first
then
thing.
World War I comes and everybody gets rich. But what about the story about the watch?
Oh, because well, Alberto,
I love that story.
Alberto Santodomas, when he was doing his blimp ride flights around the Eiffel Tower, he took up his friend Cartier, who was the jeweler in France, and he complained to Cartier that he could not look at his pocket watch because his hands were full trying to pilot this this blimp. So Cartier actually invented the wristwatch in response to Alberto Santodomas' request that he needs to tell the time, I guess, but he can't pull some watch out of his waistcoat while his hands are full. And the wristwatch, the Alberto Santodomas wristwatch is still manufactured and sold by Cartier.
Well, that's a good example of necessity.
Yeah, well, you know, Santodomas' career, he ultimately moved back to Brazil in 1928, but he was suffering from multiple sclerosis. And actually, most of his later years, he was quite depressed from illness, from the fact that this invention, this airplane that he was so invested in, was being used for so many terrible atrocities. And ultimately, he hanged himself in 1932 in Brazil. But he's a huge national hero in Brazil and, of course, in France as well. So
a lot of brilliant people, though, kill themselves. It's
yeah,
like
it's
you can only
that,
handle so much.
That manic,
yeah,
depressive,
yeah,
kind of personality.
Working hard, yeah.
Well, in 1909, the Air Club de France actually issued what were effectively pilot's licenses. And they were flying certificates, you know, the ability to fly. So they actually issued 16 retroactive pilot's licenses. Alberto Santodomas getting one. Wilbur and Orville Wright were also issued pilot's license. And because these guys had been such innovators, they didn't actually have to take the test, which was funny. So the first 16 sort of were
grandfathered
in. I guess
if you're the inventor, you cheated.
Orville and Wilbur, because they issued them alphabetically. So they were 14 and 15. And there was no number 13 issued because that
bad
was
luck.
Bad luck, yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting when you look at that list because a number of those guys died, you know, in airplane crashes. So that was interesting. So by 1910, the Wright brothers offered to donate their airplane to the Smithsonian Institute, and the Smithsonian Institute refused it.
But that's the People's Museum.
I know, but
wow.
So the Wright brothers, well, they only flew together once.
Mean in the same plane?
Yeah, because their argument was, look, if we both die, who's going to carry on? So so that was literally
they were thinking the possibility was real.
I think it was real.
Well, I think a lot of planes crashed.
So Wilbur ended up, he was involved in a lot of lawsuits. This is the way of all great
because
innovators.
Because the planes crashed?
No, because people started using their ideas. So
the patents.
The patent infringements.
Patents have always been a big deal.
So, in fact, Alexander Graham Bell was involved in, like, trying to steal some of his patents, which is how Alexander Graham Bell got the telephone in the first place.
Yeah,
but
by
that's
stealing,
a whole different
yes.
dead white scientist story. So anyway, by Wilbur Wright actually died of typhoid fever in 1912. So by 1914, I think the Smithsonian was feeling a little more energized. There was a new guy in charge, and they decided to try and rehabilitate Langley's historical perspective. So they actually hired Glenn Curtis, who was working for Bell, who was involved
Bell.
In one of the – Alexander Graham Bell.
Okay.
Who was involved in a lawsuit with the Wright brothers – to prove that Langley's airplane actually could have flown before the Wright brothers did and therefore did.
That just mean, because yeah. the reality is whether it could or couldn't, it didn't.
It doesn't matter. This is, we're
this
right,
is about
we're,
patents and a lot of money.
This is about rewriting history. So anyway, they went through this whole thing. They renovated the airplane, made a lot of modifications. Then Glenn Curtiss flew it, and they said, see, and then the Smithsonian put it on display saying, essentially, this was the first man-carrying airplane in history of the world capable of sustained free flight. And Orville Wright blew a gasket. So he then donated their plane to the Science Museum of London. Lindbergh got involved and said, look, I'm going to negotiate this dispute, try and fix this.
I mean, Charles Lindbergh, the first guy that crossed the ocean.
Right. So
in a plane.
Yeah. So it gets even crazier because ultimately it wasn't brought back to the United States until 1948, right after Orville died. And now it's acknowledged by the Smithsonian that they were lying the whole time, and away we go. But that brings us to Gustav Whitehead. And Gustav Whitehead was actually a German who lived in Connecticut, who was a he worked for a toy maker, and he made kites and gliders and little wind-up airplanes and things like that.
Oh, I love all those things.
Yeah, and so in 1896, he was hired as a mechanic to the Boston Aeronautical Society. And it is claimed that in 1901, he actually flew an airplane in Connecticut 2 years before the Wright brothers.
Uh-oh.
And you know what
Who
I find?
Who claimed that?
He did, and the newspaper, the local newspaper, had an article about it. And what's funny is when they were trying to promote the claims, he had his airplane on display, and Langley, surprise, surprise, the guy from the Smithsonian, sent a guy, and then they reported, nope, that airplane never could have flown. End of story.
Wow.
So Langley, who is still trying to promote that he was the first guy that fly, was the authority who debunked this guy. And it largely went forgotten for a long time until in the 1930s, it was resurrected in an article that appeared in an Aero magazine. At which point, Orville Wright got into the mix. He wrote a big article called, it's here somewhere, but The Mythical Whitehead Flight. So he poo-pooed the whole idea that it couldn't possibly have happened. One of his pieces of evidence is, why did they wait 4 days to print this story in the newspaper? If it
four
did,
days.
In fact, happen.
Oh, why did they wait 4 days
well,
when
the problem
it initially
is,
happened?
It was a weekly newspaper.
Oh.
Okay.
Daggone. That's just common logic. Don't go there.
Anyway, in 1986, Cliff Robertson, the actor, he stepped forward, actually flew a reproduction of Whitehead's airplane, and it flew. So there you go. The question's still up in the air. Most people will say, okay, the Wright brothers deserve it. I might say Whitehead deserves it. Alberto Dumont deserves it. The reality is a lot of people were involved. Let's give them all
Nobody
credit.
Did it by themselves. That's the case for so many things in life.
Well, you've been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. We want to thank our cauliflower eater and Emmy Award-winning producer, Adam Rich. And thank you for spending just a little bit of time with us. And as your grandmother probably told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is...
play nice with others, which we just demonstrated doesn't happen. Clean up your own mess. And Jay, eat those veggies this week. All the cauliflower you can eat.
All right. Till next time.
Mother Earth will sing, and her children will be healed. Come out, see the morning glory blossom in the night. Know the skies are dancing in twilight. Soon we'll be together, all will be revealed. Mother Earth will sing, and her children will be healed.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.